KYW News Radio Original Podcasts.
This episode of Bridging Philly includes discussion of child sexual and physical abuse. Listening discretion is advised.
From KYW News Radio 103.9 FM, this is Bridging Philly, connecting our communities on the issues that matter to you. Presented by Gift of Life Donor Program. Register as an organ donor at donorsone.org.
Hello, I'm Raquel Williams. Welcome to Bridging Philly. An award-winning play has been making its way across the country and will culminate its tour here in Pennsylvania in recognition of Child Abuse Prevention Month and Sexual Assault Awareness Month. Unreconciled is a one-man play that uncovers the fear, shame, and trauma of childhood sexual abuse. I sit down with the playwright and performer to learn his story, along with the PA representative who crafted a bill so that victims can receive justice.
This isn't really about me and my story. This is about something else that wants to come out into the world.
And Charity Howard is out and about in the city.
Welcome to Walnut Street Theater. We're going to go behind the scenes here.
Oh, that's coming up on Bridging Philly. The award-winning solo play, Unreconciled, has been touring across the country and will return to Pennsylvania this month for a two-week, three-city tour in recognition of Child Abuse Prevention Month and Sexual Assault Awareness Month. The tour supports legislation introduced by Representative Nate Davidson that would reform Pennsylvania's statute of limitations and establish a retroactive two-year civil look-back window for survivors of childhood sexual abuse. Unreconciled is a one-man play based on the true story of an adolescent actor cast as Jesus in a school play directed by a parish priest and the sexual abuse that ensued. This is Jay Sefton's story. He is the co-writer and performer of Unreconciled and executive director of the Unreconciled Project. He joins us now along with PA Representative Nate Davidson. Welcome both of you to Bridging Philly.
Happy to be here. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Absolutely. Jay, I've only seen snippets and I have read the reviews about this play and I'm already riveted. So I have to first of all say thank you for bringing this, your experience as a child victim of sexual assault, to the stage. Now, can you take us briefly back to that time where you got that part of Jesus in your school play? Interested in knowing how old you were at the time, and I can just imagine the excitement that you were feeling. I mean, because that is the role to get if you're going to be in a school play of that sort, right?
Yeah, I mean, it could be the role to get of all time, right? So I was 13, and the play had been done for the past 2 years. So this is 1985. It had been done in 83 and 84, and so this was the third year. Yeah, there was always a part of me that wanted to be an actor, and I knew it from an early age. And I was somebody that would be terrifically nervous in front of people. Like if we had to get up and read a paper, my hands would shake and then the paper would shake and then I couldn't read what was on the paper and I would get more nervous. But there was something about acting that was different. And so they held a vote amongst the classmates about who would play Jesus. And I was kind of nervous to raise my hand, but then what won out was the part that wanted to be an actor, and I did raise my hand.
Got it. Okay. And this is in Pennsylvania, right?
Yeah. So this was in Havertown, Delaware County, about 10 minutes west of Philadelphia.
So you received this role as a 13-year-old, excited, of course, but a trust, of course, was betrayed. Can you give us an overview of what happened at that time?
So this was part of the conflicting feelings about raising the hand in the first place is stories were told, whispered amongst the kids over the last couple of years about what Father Smith and what would happen with the kids playing Jesus. And it would come in the form of being made fun of. So I got the part and there was a part of me that had heard stories about having to go into a closet with Father Smith and get naked while he put on a loincloth, right? So a lot of this was done under the idea that this had to be as authentic as possible. And so, you know, if you take a look at the grand jury report from Philadelphia, there's the whole case is in there of what he would do in sadistic ways. The terms that are used are sadistic and depraved desires that were played out through the Passion play. And specifically the kids that played Jesus. And this would happen multiple times because we would rehearse there'd be dress rehearsals. There were multiple performances. It would get toured around to other schools. It wasn't a one-time thing. The play happened throughout the spring of whatever year it was getting performed.
Yeah. Okay. Of course, you don't have to get into detail, but I remember reading something about the rehearsals. What were the rehearsals like, if you can take us there?
Again, everything was put under this idea of theater's got to be authentic and realistic. He would teach the guards how to whip Jesus in a way. So he fashioned whips out of, you remember the shoes, Docksiders, that had the leather shoelaces?
Yeah.
He'd take a bunch of those together and create whips. And then he would demonstrate on me how that was supposed to go. And so one of the things was, I'd come home with welts all over me from the rehearsals and the shows. And, you know, 13-year-old kids, particularly 13-year-old boys, you put a whip in their hand and say, go to town on. I don't know that it was ever malicious, but it's just one of those things where it would end up over the top.
I mean, when you come home with those welts, what do you say? Did you tell anyone of what was happening, or were you too scared to do that even?
Well, here's some of the confusing part is, everybody knew that the Passion Play was happening. This had happened for multiple years, and it was a huge honor to be picked to play Jesus. So there's a part that's like, what do I say? Everyone knows this is happening. You know, I think there is an idea. Someone had brought this up in a talk back once of the community gets groomed as well. And so even if you've got an idea of like, I don't like this, like there were times that I said to Father Smith, can I do the loincloth myself? And it would be met with anger. So, you know, as a 13-year-old, you're like, I guess that's my answer. No. It's a confusion that happens of like, who do I tell? What do I say that's happening? Particularly when it feels like, well, everyone's endorsing this. It was a point of pride for my parents that I was playing Jesus, and they looked forward to inviting everyone to come and see the show. And so, you know, you just figure, all right, this is comes with the territory.
Wow. The way you said that the community was groomed as well. So everyone was on board. And if you want to be in this play and you have the biggest part, just get on board. This is the way it is. How did this affect you, though, growing up, you know, having that experience with you in the background? How did it affect you?
I like the way you put it, that it's in the background, because I feel like, you know, you're 13. One of the things that is sort of a great thing about humans is we are resilient to some extent. Like I had to graduate, go on to high school. I can tell you that I never pursued acting again until I was 13, maybe 10 years later is when I had the courage, but the desire never left me. I was just afraid to do it. I'm a recovering alcoholic. So, substances, when I first started to drink, the relief that came was I didn't even know the stuff that was running in the background until it got relieved. And I think about it in terms often, you know, if you have a big storm and all the electricity goes out, you realize how loud the electricity is in the moment of it going out. That's what drinking did for me. It relieved that background noise for a while until it kicked it up on the back end. But just life didn't feel like it was working. So there was lots of struggles of like, relationships.
Of course. Yeah. Understand. I can imagine. So what ultimately happened to the parish priest? I understand that there was some action that was taken.
In 2007, he was defrocked. So the grand jury report comes out in 2005. Somehow he stayed in the ministry for another 2 years. But in 2007, he was defrocked. And it was the article in the Philadelphia Inquirer that my dad happened to see. I was living in Los Angeles at the time, and he emailed it to me, and he was like, what is this? So we had that conversation.
Well, and that must have been a difficult conversation, you know, for your father to come to grips with what ultimately was happening to his son. And he was powerless in that moment. I'm assuming it was difficult for him as well.
Definitely. He was enraged. And
yeah.
So that was 2007 was sort of the first time that I came to grips with like, now this is in writing. It's not even me. You know, somebody else came forward and testified, and here's the story, but it's my story too. So it was my dad's urging at the bottom of the article, there was a line to reach out to the victim's assistance coordinator at the Archdiocese of Philadelphia. And he said, do that, call that line. And I did. that was kind of the beginning of what's leading to this tour of Unreconciled in Pennsylvania. That was the first moment.
Rep Davidson, let's talk a little bit about this bill. It's been 20 years since the first Pennsylvania grand jury report exposed widespread child sexual abuse. Talk about that time, if you can.
Yeah, it was a long time ago. First, I just want to compliment Jay for his bravery and sharing his story with all of us. You know, it's so important that survivors are able to share what happened to them so that communities know. A lot of these instances are hiding in plain sight, as Jay was saying. Yeah, I mean, 20 years ago, the grand jury report that he referenced, I think it was 05, and then a subsequent one from the attorney general in 2018. This is not a new fight. I'm not the first fighter in this fight. I'm just a freshman legislator here from central Pennsylvania. But in particular, in the state capitol in Pennsylvania, since 2012, this has been at the forefront of conversation in the capitol, which is almost 15 years now. It was after that 2018 grand jury report where things kind of hit the accelerator. And there were four recommendations from that report. And we did three of them in 2019. You know, the one was to lift the cap on criminal statute of limitations entirely so that the criminal prosecutions can take place whenever accusations are brought forward. Another is to enhance mandatory reporting laws. And then another one, which we got across the finish line way back when, was to constrain the use of confidentiality agreements. Oftentimes, these individuals in positions of authority or institutions would use and abuse an NDA or a confidentiality agreement and use that to keep the victim or survivor, you know, hidden away until that statute of limitations expired. But the fourth one here is this two-year window for survivors whose civil statute has expired. You know, I can get into the history and why that didn't get across the finish line in 2019 and 2021, but, you know, we accomplished three of those goals, and there's still a fourth outstanding.
Okay, so to bring things into perspective, specifically House Bills 462 and 464, what do they specifically call for?
So this is it opens that two-year window for survivors whose statute of limitations has expired, civil statute, to file a case in court. You know, one of the things in our justice system is that the door is open to anyone. But for these survivors whose statute of limitations has expired, time-barred claims, they can't even walk into a courthouse room and file a case. So 462 is a statutory route. That's just a changing in the law. It could be passed by the House, the Senate, and signed by the governor this year, and it would be done. And that window would open for 2 years, and those survivors would have an opportunity to file a claim or make a case, and then it would close. 464 is a constitutional amendment. Same concept, but it's a longer process. We have sent both vehicles, both a statutory vehicle and a constitutional vehicle, to the Senate, where they sit today. But I just want to read back to that grand jury report, if you would bear with me, because I think it's important to hear directly from the grand jurors about why they made this recommendation and the impact it would have. So we call for a civil window law, which would let older victims sue the diocese for the damage inflicted on their lives when they were kids. We saw these victims. They're marked for life. Many of them wind up addicted or impaired or dead before their time. The law enforced right now gives child sex abuse victims 12 years to sue once they turn 18. But victims who were already in their 30s and older fell under a different law. They only got 2 years. For victims in this age range, the short two-year period would have expired back in the 1990s or even earlier, long before revelations about the institutional nature of clergy sex abuse. And we think that's unacceptable. These victims ran out of time to sue before they even knew they had a case. The church was still successfully hiding its complicity, and this proposal would open a limited window, offering them a chance finally to be heard in court. And so all we're asking is to give those 2 years back. And I think that just cuts to the core of this issue. This is not a complex issue. This is about giving survivors an opportunity to pursue justice.
It's a simple ask. It really is. And so I understand the importance of crafting that measure. To talk a little bit more about the play, why perform this play in Harrisburg? What message are you trying to send there?
One, then this is an opportunity for me to thank you, Nate, for bringing the legislation back. There have been moments all along this journey that I think it's over. Nobody's going to pick up the mantle. So I certainly appreciate that you've done that. And all along, there's been this thought of, gosh, if we could play it in Harrisburg, because what I'd love to get across is that there are people behind the numbers of these bills. There are stories behind the legislation. And this is just a story of a town and a person. And there are thousands of them throughout Pennsylvania, similar in nature. There's clergy, and then there's all sorts of other people that fit into the statute of limitations have timed out. So, you know, to bring it to Harrisburg is this is where the change can happen. This is where, if somebody sees a theatrical telling of the story, perhaps a heart can get changed and the decision to bring it to the floor for a vote might happen. I mean, that's the hope.
What finally led you to write this play, Jay? And had you always conceived it to be a solo performance?
So I'd done a solo show when I was pursuing acting in Los Angeles more full time back in like 2008. I knew the form a little bit. My wife always joked with me because I would say, she's like, you should write another show. I'm like, I don't have another show. She's like, I think you have another show. Anyway, when the constitutional amendment fell apart in 2021, it was in January. It looked like this was going to go through and it didn't happen. And it was a kick in the gut. The bottom fell out and I was filled with rage. And it was in that moment that I thought, maybe I have another show in me. So I started writing this because I had written a couple op-eds. I was starting to find a voice, but I didn't know what to do after that. And I know that theater can have an impact if we can find our ways to sitting in a theater. And I know it's a tough ask to say, hey, I got this solo show about clergy abuse. You want to come out on a Wednesday night and see it? It's a tough ask, but the reflection that we've gotten is that it's worth being there. A lot of people say, I didn't want to come tonight, and I'm so glad that I did. We do have a lot of humor in the show. I know that's important to me. The co-author, Mark Basquiel, him and I started working maybe 4 months after that amendment fell apart. And so, you know, it's been this kind of wild, unexpected ride for the last 3 years.
Bridging Philly continues in a moment. Back to Bridging Philly, connecting our communities on the issues that matter to you.
From what I understand, Jay, you are able to immerse the audience into the world of a child experiencing pain and anger and betrayal, and that your humanity is felt because of how raw and honest the performance is. Is this play ultimately doing what you hoped that it would do?
There are three parts to that answer. I won't go into them too much, but there's the political side. We'll see. We'll see what happens in Harrisburg. There is a theater piece of it that we wanted to create a piece of theater that stands on its own. Yeah, it's got an issue to it, but there's also, like you had said, there's a community. You know, if people come in and they say, oh my God, that was 80 minutes. It felt like 10. That is the greatest compliment that I could ever hear. And if we can do that, which the reflection, we've been very fortunate to get good reviews and it feels like it's doing that. And then there's the other thing of survivors. Can we create something where they feel seen and heard and empowered to tell their stories in whatever way feels comfortable? And that's been very gratifying over the last 3 years to get some reflection that people have felt seen and heard. And so we've had that piece.
Yeah, I'm interested in hearing what victims have been saying to you, how they've been reacting to this performance and the play. It must be incredibly validating for victims to see what they're feeling, what they've experienced, play out on stage through you.
That's the hope. And sometimes, you know, we've had organically develop over the years this idea of panel discussions and talkbacks afterwards so that there can be a conversation and a place. And what we've learned is the play is really just a jumping off place. We hope that it creates a container that allows other people to join the conversation. That's the important piece of it, is that we start talking about this stuff so it doesn't hide in the shadows and is allowed to grow there. So we're hopefully bringing it out into the light. And it's been very gratifying to me over the last 3 years to see this piece of it, which I didn't foresee. It was really like, hey, there's this theater piece. And then it grows into like, oh, this isn't really about me and my story. This is about something else that wants to come out into the world.
Yeah. Bigger than yourself.
Totally.
Yeah. Rep Davidson, tell me about your experience of viewing the play. What are your thoughts on it? I know obviously it kind of helps push forward and advance, trying to get the bill passed and more people talking about it. But what are your thoughts on the play?
Well, I haven't seen it yet, so I'm looking forward to it. But I think to Jay's point about like encouraging others to join the conversation, that's really what this is about. You know, we'll have that talk back session afterwards and the following day in Harrisburg. We'll do a policy hearing with survivors and legal experts and even psychological experts about the impacts and long-term effects of child sexual abuse the following day. So really, it's about amplifying this conversation and Child Sexual Abuse Awareness Month and just bringing a light to it. And I just want to bring the importance of the timeliness here. So the constitutional amendment, it takes two consecutive legislative sessions to pass a constitutional amendment and put it in front of the voters. So if we do get it across the finish line this calendar year in 2026, this could be on the ballot in front of the voters next year in 2027. If we fail this year, then we won't see it until 2029 at the earliest. And that's why we wanted to amplify this conversation in Harrisburg this spring as the legislature returns to session to pass a budget again this year, because this is our moment.
Yeah. I guess what's coming to my mind is victims can't wait. So it's important to get this through. And, you know, ultimately, what will the bill's passage mean for survivors of child sexual assault?
I want to hear Jay's perspective here as well. But I think, and he referenced it earlier, there have been so many times where people say, I guess it's over. But then somebody else steps up and picks up the ball and moves it forward a little bit more. The former Representative Rossi, who was a champion of this issue in the Capitol, he was a survivor and very, very public about his story, rose to become the Speaker of the House. And this was his single issue for a brief period as Speaker. Again, there's been so many ups and downs. It's been this roller coaster where we move forward, one step forward, two steps back. And so passing it this year, I think would just be another indication that we're not giving up until we provide survivors the opportunity to seek justice.
Well, a couple words that I hear that come up a lot are closure and healing. And sometimes I think, oh, that may not be the right way to frame it, because I don't know that there's ever true closure or absolute healing. These experiences create an imprint on a person. And then it becomes, all right, how do we manage it? The fundamental nature of trauma is that life gets changed at an elemental level. So we want proximity to closure and healing and in the direction of, and what we've got is a court system, that's the means of trying to seek justice. If we can't do it, it interrupts the process of seeking closure, of moving toward closure or healing, even if we understand that it probably will never be done. There are continuing effects of this experience that I'll manage and get better at managing and outgrow. But this interrupts it if we can't go and do what we have that's the most complete version of it, which in this case would be seek justice in the courts. We want to move past the anger and rage, and this thing kind of gets in the way of it when it continues to get stalled and kicked down the road. And so it would mean a lot in that process, allowing it to unfold.
If I could just chime in here again, because I think every survivor's experience is different and everyone is seeking to get closer to that closure or healing in their own way. I've talked to survivors who don't want monetary compensation. That's not what they seek. They want to be told in a court of law that this happened to you. Everyone's got a different experience, but what Jay said about just denying that step to even get closer to closure and healing is the frustrating part.
Yeah, that public and official validation, I think, is important. So where has the play toured? And in terms of it being in Pennsylvania, where are some of the areas that people will be able to check it out?
So the play had its very first workshop production in Massachusetts in the summer of 2023. And since then, we've been a little all over the United States. We've been to Los Angeles. We've been to North Carolina, lots of places in Massachusetts. We've been to Belfast, Northern Ireland twice, and Galway once. We'll be in Chester County for one performance at Barley Sheaf Players in Exton on April 10th. Then we'll move into Havertown, and these shows are going to be at the bar that I grew up going to that's directly down the street from the church. So it's about a two-minute walk to the church. It's at J.D. McGillicuddy's on Brookline Boulevard from April 15th to the 19th. That's an interesting little thing for me to consider as I'm heading back, that it's going to be in Havertown, and I'll be reconnecting with a lot of people that I went to grade school with.
I was just thinking about that. Like, I was going to, obviously you can handle it, but I'm thinking in my mind, like, that's going to be, there might be some things that resurface for you.
Yeah. I don't know that it's a clear cut. Obviously I can, we'll see what happens. I mean, the show must go on, but we'll do it. I'm excited about those shows. I'm going to really be seeing some people that I haven't seen in a long time. And I appreciate the support and people buying tickets and it's selling out, which is really cool. And then, of course, we're going to be at the Gamut Theater in Harrisburg on April 22nd. It's a Wednesday at 5 p.m. That's a free performance. All of these things can be found at unreconciledtheplay.com. The Gamut Theater is a beautiful theater, steps from the Capitol, that when I went to my very first rally in 2021 on the steps of the Capitol, I walked by there and it was closed, and I went and opened the doors to see if I could pop into the theater. And I thought, oh, that's a cool looking theater. And now 5 years later, we're going to be playing there on April 22nd. So I'm thrilled about that.
Well, that's awesome. And yeah, I just want to ask you, what is it that you want people to walk away with when they see the play? After they see this 80-minute solo performance that is a true story, what do you want them to walk away with?
The greatest compliment, or what I'd like to hear and what we've had the great fortune of hearing often, is I'm so glad I was here tonight. You know, this idea that we had a theatrical experience, a theater experience that will stick with me for a while. I'd like people to think. I want them to laugh. We talked a little bit about I'd like survivors to feel seen and heard. There's a lot of people that this issue impacts and then ripples out in a community. And so I'd like it if people came away thinking this impacts people that I love, and we need to talk about it.
Yeah. I think people will be moved by this. Like I said, the little that I've seen of it, I just think it's a necessary performance to bring out your experience. And it's so personal that I can see how people will connect to this. And the performances, of course, if people need more information, as Jay indicated, just go to unreconciledtheplay.com. That big culmination on April 22nd at the Gamut Theater Group in Harrisburg is one to definitely not miss. So I'd like to thank Representative Nate Davidson for talking about the bill. And of course, Jay Sefton, thank you so much for sharing your story, for bringing your story to the stage, and for being so candid and honest that other victims actually feel validation and hopefully, you know, see some progress in this area and get some more conversations started. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Raquel. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Raquel. Appreciate you.
Bridging Philly continues in a moment. Back to Bridging Philly from KYW News Radio 103.9 FM.
Welcome back to Bridging Philly. Well, if it's happening in Philly, Shara Day Howard knows all about it as she takes you through those hidden and not so hidden gems in and around the city of Philadelphia. Hey, Shara, where are you taking us this week on Shara in the City?
This week on Shara in the City, we're going to see a side of one of Philly's oldest theaters that we've never seen before and go behind the scenes of their new show, 1776, just in time to celebrate America's 250th anniversary. And my buddy Stevie's around here somewhere. He's going to do the honors. So much to see in so little time. Oh boy, let's go. And boy, when you walk up to the theater, it's like the theater wears its history right up front. You can tell it's as old as it is. Now, where's Steve? He might be behind these big doors. Let's knock.
Why, hello there. Welcome.
Hey, how you doing?
I am doing well. So glad to have you. Welcome to Walnut Street Theater. My name is Stephen Rapp. I'm the Director of Marketing and Public Relations here, and we are so excited to have you do a little backstage tour and see something pretty special from the perspective of what the audience is going to see when they're here for 1776.
1776, everyone, come on. Perfect timing.
250 years in the making, right?
I love it. All right, so you get to show me some secret stuff?
Absolutely. You're going to go behind the scenes here. The very first place we're going to walk through actually is where our ushers prepare, and actually the green room is going to be just to our right. So we're going to look to our right, and we're going to see that as well.
I love it. I love you go from door to door to door. You get to see what no one else really gets to see.
This old place has secrets, and we're taking you through some of them.
Oh, and all of the articles on the walls. This is really cool. So what's this?
We're coming in. We're in our what's called our donor lounge here. And Bernard Havard, our producing artistic director, has been collecting the materials said about the Walnut for the better part of 40 years.
Get out.
And so he has turned the lobby spaces and any public space into basically a museum about the Walnut. We can see the era when the Barrymores, Drew Barrymore's family, owned the Walnut.
You think Philly, you think Barrymore.
Exactly. That's exactly right. All the way up to Bernard's first produced play here, a soldier play, which starred a very young Samuel Jackson at the time. And everything in between is what we have here.
Very cool. I mean, that's so Philly.
Yeah, it is absolutely Philly. It's very Philly in the way that it's happened. Okay. So now we're actually walking into the public lobby. We literally have a statue of a famous actor here.
I always wonder who this guy was. Every time I come in, who is this guy?
Right down the street, the Forrest Theater, one of our neighbor theaters, is named after Edwin Forrest. And this is Edwin Forrest right here. He performed regularly all through not just like Philadelphia, but the region, and is generally considered literally a titan of the industry. And if you ever get a chance to see this statue of him, he looks like a titan standing here, right?
He does. I was thinking, you know, the Roman toga.
Yeah, absolutely.
The 19th century mustache and little goatee kind of thing.
That definitely gives it away, right?
It does. Yeah. It looks a little like Mark Twain.
Yeah. So there's also, obviously, also a connection to the Booth family here.
Yes.
As well as...
And explain a little of that history, because I think a lot of people will be interested. And we know John Wilkes Booth, the man who shot President Abraham Lincoln. This is who we're talking about, folks. Okay, now. So he's going to explain it.
The Booth family owned the Walnut Street Theater as well as the Barrymore family. The Booth family had two very well-known actors, one of whom has gone on to infamy, but his older brother actually still has a theater named after him in New York, the Booth Theater, and he was a very regular performer in this area entirely. He was kind of the, for lack of a better term, like the Tom Hanks or the Denzel Washington of his time.
Oh boy.
Where he was known to do anything and everything. It was basically one of the most famous actors of his generation.
Yeah, actor of all trades.
Exactly.
Do it all.
Exactly. That's exactly it. Cool. Shall we continue on inside the theater?
Next.
Great. We are going to actually walk right into the theater now. And what we are going to see here is our restored fire curtain. And you have not seen it yet.
I haven't. So how old is this building anyway?
The building itself was built in 1808. Where we are standing right now, which is in the middle of the orchestra floor, this place was a horse circus. And so where we are standing is where the circus itself performed, which is really neat.
I had no idea.
There you go. You've welcome to the circus, my friend. That's the theater biz.
It's my life.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly, right? So this place was then retrofitted into a theater after that. We have been continuously running. This is our 217th season. Next year will be our 218th season. But this year's season, the 217th, is culminating with 1776. So not quite aligned with 250, but oh, so close, right?
So close, yeah. By a hair.
Yeah. Well, let's walk up close and take a look at the fire curtain here.
So let's talk about this fire curtain.
Yeah,
what exactly is that? Is it self-explanatory?
So it might not be to a modern audience because it's not necessarily something that modern audiences see a whole lot of. But back in the day, in the 1800s and in the 1900s, it was very normal that natural gas was used for the lighting elements in theater, which I don't know if you're aware or your audience is aware, but natural gas is highly flammable, as it turns out.
Oh, I remember the whole blocks being told of whole blocks in the 1800s that would just go up from a candle that really took light.
That would literally just ignite something much larger, right? Mm-hmm. And so it was discovered that obviously in using natural gas, that fires were very common. And so it became required for them to have a version of a fire curtain so that if a fire took place on stage, which was the most common place on stage or backstage for them to happen, they could literally just drop in a fire curtain that had fire retardant materials on it and could separate the audience from the fire. And so the fire curtain was simply pulled up about three stories up in the air, mm-hmm. and has just been hanging here for 100 years, and no one saw it.
So the decay factor.
And so there, and so there was some decay factor there as well. And the Arcadia Foundation said, let's bring this thing up to 21st standards. And so they repaired, cleaned, and sealed in all the old fire retardant elements. And so it is safe to be down, and literally hasn't, we don't exactly know when the last time it was seen, but we think it's been maybe 100 years since an audience has seen it, but we don't know for sure.
Oh my gosh, and we're looking at it now. It's gorgeous.
We are looking, it is literally and figuratively a work of art.
So this was actually painted then. This is the same image that was on the curtain?
This is the exact same image that was on the curtain, which is a reproduction of a painting called The Bell's First Note. And the artist who painted The Bell's First Note actually oversaw the creation of this fire curtain. Wow. And it is literally going to be a treat for people to see. Yeah,
wow. And then the right gilded there. Frame around it, the bell, the blacksmith. I mean, it's a whole scene.
It's like a Where's Waldo of what can you find in this painting next. It is absolutely gorgeous.
I mean, you can't miss the 1776. So let's talk about it a little bit.
Yeah, let's talk about it.
What about this musical really is going to draw people in?
Well, I'll tell you what. Obviously, the world was set, I'll use Fire Curtain as an example, on fire with Hamilton, right?
Yeah.
That came out. I think people have heard of that.
I think it's, yeah, maybe.
And so I think it kind of reignited this passion and this love for what is the history of our country? How did it happen? 1776 really dives into that window of time where the Declaration of Independence was actually made. And what did it take for them to haggle or negotiate the what was included, what was excluded? Right. What were people thinking and feeling at the time where they were doing that? So it's going to take, I'm going to call them characters, but these are historical figures of our past. George Washington, John Adams, Abigail Adams, Martha Washington. What was happening on the stage here in the world? Mm-hmm. And how did they actually arrive at that moment? And of course, Independence Hall
is right down the street.
It's 2 or 3 blocks away. This all happened in Independence Hall. And so we are taking it right to the stage. Yeah.
So give us a hint. Who's in it?
Yeah. So it has some Philadelphia favorites. So Ben Dibble is actually playing John Adams. Scott Greer is playing Benjamin Franklin. Jeff Koons is going to be playing one of the characters here. He started at the Walnut 30 years ago. With 1776.
So for him, full circle.
Yeah, it is a full circle moment for Jeff Koons. So this is going to be an enormous Philadelphia cast. There's a cast of about 25 actors. For a lot of people, it's going to reignite that love of history. For others, it's going to teach them about our own history, right, that we are now living in. So it's going to really be an awesome moment for Philadelphia. We want it to feel like a celebration.
So this musical is coming up soon.
It's coming up very soon. So first performance will be April 14th, and it will run through the end of May, May 31st. So make sure you're a part of the celebration.
History, yeah. Arts, culture in Philly. Can't do better than this.
We have it all right here. All we need to do is look around, right?
Thank you for joining us. Bridging Philly is brought to you by Gift of Life Donor Program. Register as an organ donor at donorsone.org. For more information on Bridging Philly, follow KYW News Radio on social media. And if you have any ideas for interesting features that you'd like to share, feel free to get in touch with us at bridgingphilly@kywnewsradio.com. For Sharaday Howard and our producer Sabrina Boyd-Circa, I'm Raquel Williams. Be well.